You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, today is part three of a lecture given by Miles Gilbert on May the 28th, 1998, at our annual conference at the Thunder Horse Ranch. So, please, sit back, take notes if you want to, and enjoy.
And he's a very widely distributed in Hopi land. Well, looks like that's what we have for slides and country clips, so I'd like to get the lights on and let's see if anybody has any questions or comments. Following this, I smell chocolate cake.
Yeah.
I really do. But for those of you who are even mildly interested in the buffalo hunters, I have a few slides and some comments on the buffalo hunter. Glad to give you that. Also, during this break, before we do that, if anybody wants to buy a copy of Jim Kelmel's really excellent book, I can recommend this because I didn't write it. I don't make any money off of it, so I don't mind selling it to you. No conflict of interest here.
You want the copy?
These are $15. Well, in actuality, they're $14.95, but I don't charge tax, and it's easy if we don't have to make change. Give me $15, and Kunkel will be glad to get it. This has been a phenomenal experience for me. Never, ever have I sold a copy of Getting a Stand before I gave the talk. You all are very confident, evidently, in the material that we're about to present. Earlier this afternoon, we talked about
the Buffalo Gun.
Earlier this afternoon, we talked about Ice Age hunters who tackled really big animals like mammoth. They were specifically called Clovis because the type site was located in Clovis, New Mexico. And the animals that they specialized in hunting again were mammoth. This is a neck bone, one of the seven cervical vertebrae that a mammoth has. In fact, all of us mammals have the same number of neck bones. We all have seven cervical or neck vertebrae. If you take your index finger and run down the back of your shirt to about where your shirt collar is, you will find a bony protuberance. That is the spinous, that would be the spinous process of the seventh or last cervical vertebra. So whether you're a long-necked giraffe or a short-necked human or a short-necked mammoth, we all have the same number of neck bones. And this, again, then, is one from a mammoth. Mammoths were big. In fact, we use the word mammoth to indicate something that is big. You all read the Johnny Hart DC comic strip? DC's a caveman. He has a friend named Thor. DC says to Thor one time, "Why do we call them mammoths?" And Thor doesn't have a clue. And DC said, "Well, it's so much easier to say than humongouses." These animals were humongous. Maybe 14 feet tall at the shoulder, might weigh 12 or 13 tons, feet about 18 inches in diameter. In fact, for those of you who have visited Melbourne or Vero Beach, Florida, in the Ice Age beach sand there is preserved a series of 18-inch diameter mammoth tracks, and mixed in amongst those is a very, very squished human skeleton. I said we got very little Ice Age human skeleton material. Well, the score on that one was Mammoth 1, Hunters Nothing. Those Clovis hunters used stone projectile points about this size to kill mammoths. And they may indeed have been successful in killing the last mammoth. I suspect that the demise of the Ice Age animals was caused by a climatic change, and so the herds were reduced due to climatic change, and then people probably were successful in killing the last one. The modern buffalo or bison has been successfully taken by Native American hunters using spears equipped with small points like this. This is a dart point. This is actually too heavy because of stone weight. It's too heavy to be a successful arrowhead. So buffalo were killed with darts thrown with what we call a spear thrower. The Native American term is atlatl. It's just an extension of the forearm, gives you greater leverage, and you can throw a stone-tipped spear very accurately and with great force. But the Plains Indians and others, after they acquired the bow and arrow at about AD 450, were successful in hunting the buffalo with tiny little arrowheads. Arrowheads this size, collectors often refer to as bird points, thinking unknowingly that such a tiny thing would be useful only for a bird, turkey or goose or some such thing. But because I did my master's thesis on 6 truckloads of bone, that'll let you off easy at the University of Kansas. 6 truckloads of bone from archaeological sites in the Missouri River Trench, mostly in South Dakota, I recovered a tremendous number of true arrowheads, just like these from the bones, the vertebra of buffalo and also of elk. During the period we call the Little Ice Age, which would be from AD 1450 to about 1870, maybe 1880 here in Arizona, there was a great deal more moisture in North America. And that increased moisture and cooler temperatures resulted in the creation of tremendous grasslands throughout much of North America, the plains states. And those grasslands supported at least, this is a conservative estimate, at least 34 million of the animals that we call buffalo, bison, bison, bison. Beginning in 1870, buffalo were shot just for their hides. The Industrial Revolution, was kicking in, and leather belts were needed to run the machines of industry. And until 1870, American leather goods, including belts for running industry, were made from the hides of Argentine cattle. But in 1870, there was a tremendous die-off of cattle in Argentina, so a new source of leather was needed, and it was found that the hide of the American buffalo could be tanned into usable leather, whether you wanted an industrial belt, a pair of boots, or maybe tan it with the fur on and use it to cover your bed, your buggy, your sleigh, whatever, simply for warmth. Tan it and sew it into a coat, make a buffalo overcoat, that sort of thing. So, beginning in 1870, buffalo were shot just for their hides. The animal was skinned, and maybe the tongue was taken, maybe the hunter would take a little meat for his own use and that of his camp tender and so forth, but for the most part, the animals were simply left to rot. And early on in the game, this is according to Richard Irving Dodge from Dodge City, Kansas, who made, early on, for every buffalo hide that got to market, 4 buffalo were shot. The guys didn't know right away how to handle those hides so that they wouldn't rot. Well, in 14 years, something over 34 million buffalo were shot for their hides. Now, I don't know how many drowned crossing the ice in the river. I don't know how many of the Indians continued to kill for their own use. I don't know how many died in blizzards or whatever. But I do know that we can account for something over 34 million shot for their hides. So, with that bit of introduction, we'll get the lights off and I'll get the slide turned on here. Well, 1870 through the winter of 83-84.
And the Louisiana era, they used that for that spear for hide better than the big head. Is that why? That was more successful for the
You might.
I'd look into how much it costs to feed a horse before I tried to feed a buffalo.
I'll also look into how much it costs to keep one in a pen. They're extremely strong animals.
Yeah. I heard one guy in Colorado used to use a tire on steel poles. So when they ran the fence, they don't knock it down.
Lloyd Phillips, a ranger friend of mine in Wyoming, and he, when I met him in 1973, he had 35 buffalo, and he also had wild horses that came down on his place. And he was a fan of the wild horse as well as the buffalo, so he'd beat them. He said one morning he went out to check on his herd, and the stallion of this particular band of wild horses was contesting ownership of a bale of hay with the buffalo, which stuck the horse here and threw the horse over the buffalo's back, just threw him off. The pony had to weigh, maybe 900, maybe 1,100 pounds, like that. Well, this is the subject of our talk, bison, bison, bison. This particular one photographed at Custer State Park in South Dakota. But again, as I mentioned earlier, during the Ice Age, there was a solid land bridge between northeastern Europe, Asia, and northwestern North America. And the oldest remains of buffalo are found in Europe and Asia. And so buffalo and elephants and people came across this way. And according to W.T. Hornaday, you know what I did? I sold the book that was under this line of Decker. Nice that you're able to edit this film. So, this is what Hornaday came up with as the range of the American buffalo at the time of first settlement. Here, well, first of all, let me beg your pardon. There were buffalo down at the edge of Tidewater, Virginia, when our colonists settled in Jamestown. Just to get you oriented, this would be Long Island, and this is about where Washington, D.C. is, and here's the Norfolk, Virginia. So, we had buffalo this far east, and we had them this far west. Notice, however, that they're still a little bit east of the Arizona border. Here would be the Arizona border coming up right here. That would be the Four Corners. So, here we are in the White Mountains of Arizona. So, according to Hornaday, they didn't get into Arizona. And notice then, as we get more recently in time, now the range shrinks from 1795, 1810, 1825, 1876, and 1883, and then the very last little handful were right up there. So, as settlement went to the west, the buffalo went to the west. Buffalo were so numerous that this reporter said that he could see them rubbing on the telegraph pole 50 yards from his dugout at Coyote Station in Kansas along the railroad line. This brown mass out here represents herds of buffalo. Richard Irving Dodge, who is a reputable historian, again, the man for whom Dodge City was named, reported that a buffalo herd that was 6 miles wide passed Dodge City over the course of 3 days. Solid mass of buffalo moving south, from north to south. As winter approached, they headed south. So here we have a chap, a professional hide hunter, who's ambushed up here using a sharp rifle. He's equipped with 2 cartridge belts, typically 40 rounds per belt. And he's equipped with what's called a hunter's companion. It has sharpening steel and 2 knives, a straight-bladed knife and a curved-bladed knife. The straight-bladed knife he will use to rip up the belly, and the curved knife he will use then to peel the hide off. And so he's simply laying down to shoot the animal. My book is titled Getting a Stand because the hunters referred to the action of watching a herd of buffalo, determining which was the leader, and shooting that animal first. Without leadership, the rest of the animals would stand around. So he could shoot as many of them as he and his standard could handle in a day. So they call that getting a stand. And the book has a table recording how many individual buffalo were shot by individual men at a given stand. Tom Dixon, who became sheriff of Dodge City later on, in October of 1872, made a boast in the Long Branch Saloon in Dodge City that he could get a stand on more buffalo than anybody ever had. Well, wagers were made, bets were placed. He took two rifles, he went out southwest of Dodge City, and in 45 minutes, by witness to count, in 45 minutes, he shot 110 buffalo. At that time, it was the biggest stand that was known. Another way to shoot buffalo would be to sit and support one's rifle either on cross sticks or, in this case, this man is using an arquebus holder. This was already an antique even at the time that this action was taking place in the 1870s. This is a kind of a pronged iron rod that was brought over by the Spanish to hold up their arquebus. Now, he's using his arc rifle. He has a second rifle so that when this one gets too hot, he can lay it down and take up the other one. He's got a canteen of water and a cleaning rod so he can clean the bore and cool off the gun. He's got two cartridge belts. And so there he is getting a stand on a herd. This fellow is using cross sticks. This actually represents Wright Moore, his brother. This fellow killed 20,500 buffalo in his six-year career. And so here he is down in the Texas panhandle of sagebrush and buffalo grass and the herd of buffalo, and he's got a 16-pound gun that he's using. I regret that this is so poorly illustrated. This is a Charles Marion Russell sketch of the buffalo hunter shooting. Russell got up into Montana while the buffalo hunters were still active, and so this may have been an eyewitness account that he sketched here. And here we have an actual photograph by L.A. Huffman taken in January of 1882 up in Montana. These guys have horses. Their guns are very heavy, so it's smart to have a horse. You notice that this buffalo's head has been cut off. Because the buffalo has such a tall hump on its back, it's extremely difficult, impossible, to get one laid up on its back. It's going to roll over one way or the other. So if you cut its head off, you can use the animal's head as a wedge to help prop it upright. Another way, well, that's what they've done here. Another photograph by Huffman. So they use their straight knife to rip down the belly, and now they're laying the hide off on either side. The white is the fatty tissue underneath the skin. This is what is next to the flesh. And here's another Huffman photograph. That's a 14-pound sharp rifle in a personal collection now. Another way to prop the animal up is to use what they call a Pritchell stick. It has one sharp end and then has a spike of metal in the other end. You get the animal tipped up and then poke that into the hide to keep him upright so that you can rip him open in and get the hide off. This guy is equipped with a sharp military rifle, a canteen, a pair of binoculars, hunter's companion again with the sharpening steel and two knives. And of course he's got his wagon to put the hide in. These photographs were made in the Texas Panhandle, Knox County, Texas, in 1874. And here at the bottom we have buffalo tongues hanging on a rack. The tongues would bring 50 cents apiece, whereas the hide might bring only a dollar. Initially, the hide would be staked out so that the flesh side was up, hair side down. These have evidently, this one is now flesh side down, hair side up. That one's still got flesh side up. They would typically be pinned out with 16 or 18 pegs. This chap sitting over here is next to a sharpening stone. You'd have to keep your knife sharp. Here we have some more hides that are laid flesh side down, so they spent 3 or 4 days with the hair side down and the flesh side up so they could get dry.
Well, can we pause it for just a second? Can somebody get that light out of here, please?
My friend Leo Riniger, this is his name down here, Riniger. Leo got me interested in this. I'd already done this this book, and he read the book and enjoyed it, and put me on some names of some other guys. So he really has initiated this Buffalo Hunter encyclopedia that I'm working on. I told someone that I have now 640 names of individuals who were in the business. But Leo kind of idealized the Buffalo Hunter's appearance here. He is fairly clean shaven, you know, neatly trimmed beard. He's got a Smith & Wesson American, probably 44 American caliber, got a 16-pound sharp, and a very nice buffalo overcoat, Hunter's companion again with the steel in the middle, nice boots and all that. So this is what Leo thinks the Buffalo Hunter ideal would look like. Well, are you ready? Here they are. These are the real McCoy, so to speak. Skirl is looking old, a powder keg. Here's a Birkin or wooden bucket, another powder keg. And these guys bought lead by the ton. They buy maybe 4,000 pounds of lead to mold and cast their bullets. A Buffalo Hunter's cartridge would throw as little as 70 grains of powder, as much as 120 grains of powder. The bullet would weigh as little as 370 grains for a 40 caliber gun, as much as 550 grains for a 45 or 50 caliber gun. And you know that an ounce of lead weighs 437 grains. So you would have to have a tremendous amount of lead if you're going to go out and shoot thousands of buffalo and average two, maybe three rounds per hive. So here's another military rifle hanging in the wagon bows, heavy sharps in this guy's hand, sharpening steel. And notice this cat has lost an arm, probably a Civil War veteran. In fact, here was money to be made literally on the hook. A lot of guys survived the Civil War, interested in adventure, like the American West, and didn't mind the smell of gunpowder. So it was an actual thing for them to get into, to become buffalo hunters. Well, here's a wagon load of pipes on its way to market, and here's an actual photograph of 500 buffalo hives, 1876, and these would be, by this time, these would be down in the Texas Panhandle. The buffalo were shot out of Texas by the winter of 78-79, and people in Texas were concerned that all our buffalo were getting killed by these damn buffalo hunters. We ought to do something about it. And so they prevailed upon the legislature of the state of Texas to pass a law prohibiting the shooting of buffalo. And Bill Sheridan got wind of that, so he went to address the Texas legislature, and he said, "You've got this all wrong, boys." He said, "You ought to, instead of prohibiting buffalo hunting, what you ought to do is mint a medal to give to buffalo hunters." He said, "It'd have a dead buffalo on one side and a discouraged Indian on the other." The buffalo, this is a direct quote now, "The buffalo hunters have done more than the regular army has in the last 30 years to settle the vexed Indian problem." So buffalo hunters continued to shoot buffalo in Texas until they were gone. What is the old axiom? An army moves on its stomach. And the stomach of the Indian army, the Comanches and the Kiowa and Apaches and all those, was the herds of buffalo. So remove the buffalo, the Indian has to go to the reservation. Here's Robert Wright sitting on a pile that was numbered, actual number, 14,000 buffalo hives inside this yard at Dodge City, Kansas. In the background is a big press, a big press for baling these hives and the bales so they could be easily transported to market. Well, here's our buddy Tom Nixon. He became sheriff of Dodge City. That's Jim White, one of the really famous buffalo hunters. and Henry Hubert Raymond playing the fiddle. They're in a little dugout outside Dodge City at Christmas of 1873. And notice the Army surplus stuff that they have. This is 1873, so they already have, as Army surplus, the 50 caliber trapdoor Springfield replaced in 73 by the 4570. They have a U.S. Surplus canteen. They've got U.S. surplus ammunition. In fact, if a Buffalo hunter went to an Army post and presented himself to the commanding officer, he could get surplus free, talking about ammunition. Now, nice little McClellan saddle there for those of you who are fans of that kind of Western Americana. Here's a couple of guys with the hair of the bear on them. There was a law against hunting buffalo in Indian Territory. You could hunt anywhere north of the Cimarron, but you couldn't go south of the Cimarron. Well, the buffalo were shot out by July of 1873, shot out in the vicinity of Dodge City. So these guys, Wright Moore and his buddy Webb, went south of the Cimarron looking for buffalo. And do they look like they're well supplied? All these guys are carrying is their rifles, ammunition, and in their saddlebags, they've got salt. They are depending on finding buffalo. Again, those of you who are Western horsemen recognize that this is a descendant of the Spanish barb. He's got a short back. He's got one less lumbar vertebra than a normal horse, and he's got those little bars on his legs. That's indication of his Arabian, his Arabian ancestry.
When they went out like that, Miles, wouldn't they have their skinners following them? I mean, what did they bring back all the hides if all they had was two horses?
This was a scouting trip. They were going to go find out where the herds were. And then, after they did, well, they got down there. They found buffalo, all right. They found man Indians. Right, horse that I got down on one knee and took him. And so he had to hold these guys back. They found buffalo by the million, so they went back to Dodge City and requested an interview, got a meeting with Richard Irving Dodge. And he asked them a zillion questions about what it was like to be a buffalo hunter, this and that and the other. And finally they said, well, Mr. Dodge, Colonel Dodge, you haven't answered our question. Well, what was it? They said, what would your policy be towards us if we crossed the neutral strip? In other words, what would the Army do if we broke the law? And he said, boys, if I was a buffalo hunter, I'd hunt buffalo with a buffalo wire. They did. So they came down to the Texas Panhandle and they shot buffalo by the gazillions. But some of them got shot. And here's a fire-headed buffalo gun in possession of a Native American, and you know he didn't buy it at the Southern Post. He took it off a buffalo hunter. In fact, Marshall Sewell was one of many buffalo hunters known to have been killed by Native Americans, and here is Red Dog, a prominent man among the Oglala, a variety of the Sioux of Lakota, and this is undoubtedly a 52.5 inch, one of the really big heavy buffalo guns. So, you know, he didn't buy that either. You all may not realize this, but these guys didn't have cell phones in their wagons. So, how are they going to communicate when they separate? This is John Cloud Jacobs partnering with John William Poe and Joe McCombs. McCombs and Poe have gone on out on the range, and they sent Jacobs into town to sell the hives and to resupply. Well, how's he going to know where to find them? They said, when we come to a fork in the road, following Gilbert Berry's advice, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Well, how's he going to know which way to go? They said, when we come to a fork in the road, we will go off to the side, and we will drive a little stake, and we will bury a tomato can with instructions on where to go next. He was mighty, mighty pleased to meet up with his comrades. Folks, that is Comanche country, and a man alone like that with a team of oxen, he's not going to outrun anybody. And he's going to run out of ammunition before he gets them all. That's a very scary position to be in. He was mighty pleased to meet up with his buddy. Well, here's McCombs, and this is Poe. And this is the first of a series of of incidents in which a buffalo was thought to be dead, but had decided not to be just yet. So McCombs had the laying plan. In remembrance of this, this guy presented to him a Remington Smoot revolver, nicely engraved, mother of pearl grips, cased, and if I'd been willing to mortgage my home, I could have bought that gun. But it had a very nice inscription from Poe to McCombs, Fort Griffin, Texas, 1874. Well, here's another buffalo that wasn't quite dead. He was laying there looking dead. The guy brings his wagon up to peel the hide off, and the buffalo decides not only not to be dead, but to go for a ride. This is Spotted Jack, who was later killed by the Comanches. He went up and sat down on this ostensibly dead buffalo and gave him a ride into this little flying lake in the Texas Panhandle. And this is Robert Warren Chambers, who, after the buffalo were gone, he took his buffalo hide money and sent himself to school, became a school teacher and then a lawyer, and wrote his reminiscences from Colorado Springs, died about 1936. But this is his very first shot of the buffalo. He's sneaked up this ravine, this gully. He's sneaked up this ravine, this gully, arroyo, and grabs hold of a sagebrush and cuts loose with his 49 bottleneck cartridge sharps. And the bush pulls out with the recoil of his weight. He lands down unconscious and doesn't know until the next day that his first shot has been successful. Later on, as an amateur, he visited the camps of the professionals, and they asked him, "Son, how many rounds do you use for a hide?" And he said, They were kept count. They said, "Well, you want to average no more than 2 rounds for a hide." So this particular morning, he has shot 16 buffalo with 32 rounds. And he goes out among them and starts skinning. He finds his old cow's not dead yet. So rather than shoot her again and spoil his average, he thought, "Well, I'll just cut her throat with my knife." Well, it was a big mistake. She knocked him over. Here, I felt her hot breath on the back of my neck. Well, eventually, he gets his leg scooched up under him and zips out. The buffalo chases him around, and she finally expires from the wound at her side. Lots of exciting adventures. This is Dutch Henry Bourne, very famous horse thief. After the buffalo hunt was over, he made his living stealing horses. But here he is skinning out a cow. Didn't notice the calf slipping up behind him, and took revenge on the death of his mother. By the way, I want to point out that these are drawn by Bill Lefkowitz. She was president of the Texas Cowboy Artists Association at the time that he did this. He's still a very famous artist in Texas. He did a life-size bronze of Bobby Murphy for the state of Texas, and he did a bronze of Bear Bryant for the state of Alabama. And, you know, those Alabamans came highly of Bear Bryant. So they chose a pretty good artist. These are Tweeds. These boys have just come over from the old world. They can probably speak 3 words of English among them. They find their way out to Dodge City, and they find out that they can make a good living shooting buffalo. They go out on the plains in October, very poorly equipped for October weather in Denver. You may have heard the phrase that in the plains, blizzards come sudden and soon in the dead of night or the blaze of moon. Well, these boys experienced the northern, a cold wind, and so they wrapped up in these fresh buffalo hides and found that every buffalo was well equipped with varmints. So they're all scratching themselves. They've got lice and fleas and ticks. Here's our buddy Robert Warren Chambers again. This particular event, he was 9 miles across the Montana Prairie from his dugout, and he shot 8 buffalo bulls late in the day and began to skin them out when a blizzard blew up. There's snow in the air. And he gets disoriented in the blizzard, wandering around across the prairie for hours, even after dark. And finally, he said, "Here I was freezing to death and seeing a fire in the snow." His imagination has gone wild with him. He thinks that he's looking into the gates of hell itself. How else would you explain seeing a fire in the snow in the middle of a blizzard out there? I mean, his mind is just, he's crazy. Well, it's good to make a cocker's sharp rifle in case Satan appears. But I would say by the providence of God, this man has wandered across the prairie and is standing on the dugout, standing on the roof of his own dugout, looking down his own chimney. Here's a little vignette. This is Frank Collinson, and that's Jim White. Jim White's headed for Montana to shoot buffalo. The buffalo were shot out in Texas here. This is the winter of 78-79. And they've partnered for several years, and they've got this dog that they both like. It's part Malamute and part bull. And they both want the dog, and they don't think it's fair to the dog to flip a coin, so they decided they would just separate and see which one the dog followed. They could go with whoever liked best. Good thing for the dog that he chose Frank Collinson. Jim White was quite a drunkard. He would spend his hide money on booze, and here he is out in the plains with his new partner, Oliver Perry Hammond. He's got delirium tremens. He's running across the prairie thinking somebody is after him, and his buddy Hannah back there has a bottle, you know, the hair of a bear to, or the hair of a dog, whatever the phrase is, to help him get over it, come down a little at a time. They built a cabin up on what's now called White's Creek after Jim White. It's on the west slope of the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming, across the mountains from Sheridan. And Hannah had a feeling that he ought to go back east across the Bighorn Mountains to check on his place over there. And while he was gone, probably Big Nose George and his gang came and killed White and piled him over there in the trees, and we got covered up with the snow. A few years later, Hannah found his Sharps rifle in a blacksmith shop down at ETC or Wood River, somewhere down there, recognized his gun, but old White was shot through the head probably with his own rifle. He's now reburied at Old Trail Town in Cody, Wyoming. If you get up to Cody, you can see the Hannah White cabin, and I had the privilege of firing a shot out of Hannah's rifle over Jim White's grave. That's got to have been 10 years ago now. Excuse me, Bill.
Who's Big Nose Pete?
Big Nose George was a pretty famous outlaw. Held up stage coaches, robbed banks. And he's just a bad dude. He finally was caught and hung. Big Nose George is the subject of one of Charlie Russell's famous paintings. He's out holding a double barrel shotgun on a stagecoach driver. Bad dude. Well, this guy was caught with his nephew, just a teenager. Rather than go to the work of shooting and skinning buffalo, they found a very lucrative living in stealing hides from the guys who had shot and skinned them. Guys would leave piles of hides out on the prairie, just with rocks on them, and of course they'd put their own camp mark on them, indicating ownership. They'd just go off and leave them, and these dudes would come along and throw them on the wagon and take them off the market. Well, they finally got caught, and so they, shall we say, they got a confession under duress. Discouraged him from continuing that activity. But when the buffalo were all shot for hides, and I want to point out again, as reprehensible as this seems to have shot all these animals for their hides, the Little Ice Age supported the grasslands that supported the buffalo. The Little Ice Age ended here in this county in 1883. It got drier. By 1890, and since 1890, this part of Arizona and the Southwest have been tremendously drier than they were in the preceding 450 years. The point of this is that the buffalo habitat would have reduced radically anyway. And of course, with continuing Western settlement by us people, buffalo habitat would have been reduced. So the vast herds of buffalo would have been reduced even had they not been shot just for their hides. Well, after the buffalo were gone, what we have left is a prairie covered with buffalo bones, and many a settler, homesteader, family would eke out a living, not only farming, but by gathering bones. Early on, and by that I mean 1881, 1882, you could get are you ready for this? You could get $6.50 a ton for buffalo bones. By the end of the game, say 1888-89, when all the bones were picked up, you might get $14 a ton. Here we have, according to the Minot, North Dakota Daily News, on July 3, 1889, 103 teams accompanied by about 500 Métis hauled bones into town that day to be on hand for the 4th of July celebration. So these are wagons full of buffalo bones gathered by the Métis around Old Devil's Lake, North Dakota, up in that country. The bones were used for, any of you have bone china at home? Bones were burned to make filters, charcoal filters, for sugar refining. And of course, bone was also ground up and used for fertilizer, bone fertilizer. So those were the major markets for buffalo bone. A ton of bone, 2,000 pounds of bones, would require about 100 skeletons of adult buffalo. So here they are piled up along the railroad side to be put in the boxcars. And any of you who are into the buffalo decor, like that one up there, that buffalo skull today would cost about $250 to buy that to hang on the wall. And that's, I checked the market just the other day. This skull, the photograph taken in Detroit, Michigan, that pile is nothing but buffalo skulls. Every one of those zombies is buffalo skull. Well, I mentioned that the buffalo then were removed from the Texas Panhandle, but the prairie was still good. And this is about 1876. This is Charles Goodnight, pioneer Texas cattleman, plainsman. He was also born in 1836, died in 1929, and brought longhorn cattle into the Texas Panhandle, where the buffalo had been on the range. Now there were cattle. He met John Adair at a Denver stock show, and he borrowed $100,000 at 20% annual interest and made them both wealthy. Because the buffalo were gone, the grass was still there.
He was famous for something else, too.
Charles Goodnight?
Yeah, he gave Billy the Kid his first job.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
This is what the Texas Panhandle looks like today. The climate has changed drastically. We are in a drought cycle compared to what we were in the previous 400 years. So this is as good as it gets in the Texas Panhandle. I took that photograph on a morning where there was a lot of hoar frost, but this is where the Goodnight Ranch was located. Well, I mentioned that the buffalo moved on the stomach, but the buffalo gone, these guys had to go onto the reservation, but they did not go quietly. Here's Osteo Charles Marsh and his paleontology students. They were out on the prairie looking for dinosaurs, and they barely escaped meeting the Plains Indians. In fact, Sternberg from Canada is looking for fossils out in the eastern Montana area on the morning of June 28, 1876. He came across a tremendous trail of travois, hundreds of thousands of horses and so forth. If he had been in that spot a few days earlier, it would have been Custer and Sternberg. This is Billy Dixon. I mentioned to you that Billy Dixon was at the Battle of Adobe Walls in the Texas Panhandle in 1874, June of 74. And it was Billy Dixon who made the so-called mile-long shot. The distance was actually 1,532 measured yards from Adobe Walls. He shot a Comanche off his horse. He's famous for another reason. He received the Congressional Medal of Honor because he survived a standoff in a buffalo wallow. This is a buffalo wallow. Dixon and a handful of soldiers fought off the Kiowa. This is all the cover that they had. And because Billy Dixon was such a good shot, such a hero, he got the Congressional Medal of Honor. This is how Leo Remiger received Wright Moore. On the day in 1876 when he shot one of the few white buffalo I could account for, I've written an article documenting six albino or white buffalo in the 34 million known buffalo that were shot in the course of the buffalo hunt. This is how Rightmore looked after his retirement. This is one of his two guns. He had an 11-pound gun and a 14-pound gun, and he said he killed about 15,000 with his 11-pound gun and only about 6,000 with his 14-pound gun. Those are both on display in the museum in Snyder, Texas, where Mr. Moore retired. Here's Oliver.
I'm sorry, Mom.
Go ahead, Bill.
What do they do about the barrels? I mean, how can you fire that, two rounds of buffalo minimum? How can they fire that many rounds through a barrel without burning out their
airplane? Bill has brought up a very good point. First of all, the big guns, 11 pounds, that one we shot today weighs 12 pounds. The guns were typically fired with ammunition that had paper patched bullets, and they were well cared for. But today, if you find a buffalo gun for sale on the market, it's rare to find one that has a good bore. They did get shot out. And a friend of mine in Scottsdale has a gun that I think is the primo, the A plus Ultra. There's not a better example of a buffalo hunter gun. His letters that his Sharps factory indicates that the gun was shipped to Fort Griffin, Texas in 1877. And it was subsequently rebarreled by A.D. McCausland in Bozeman, Montana. So it was used in both the southern herd and the northern herd. And yeah, the original barrel was simply shot out. Worn out and put in a new barrel. So here's Oliver Perry again on the 50th anniversary of the Custer's last stand, and he is holding a 16-pound gun, caliber 44-77 bottleneck, letters to Mark Bedell in Kit Carson, Colorado in 1872. He got this gun from Jim White and then recovered it at that blacksmith shop in Fayetteville, Wyoming. The name finally came to him, and he recovered it in Fayetteville. And I got it and presented it to Bob Aker of Old Trail Town named Cody, named for this guy, Buffalo Bill Cody, who is not in my Buffalo Hunter Encyclopedia because he didn't shoot buffalo for their hides. Bill Cody got his reputation shooting between 4,000 and 5,000 for me to feed the Union Pacific Railroad, the Kansas Pacific Railroad guys. And this is an illustration of oil painting by Fred Fellows himself, a collector of fine buffalo memorabilia, lives up at the Big Fork, Montana. And I believe that's the last one. So, any questions or comments on this, we can get the lights on, and I appreciate your attention and interest in this.
No, it goes off, Bob.
History. So, thank you all very much. You've been a great audience. Well, thank you. Yeah. If anybody saw the screen, I didn't hear you just before. Now,
anybody have any questions?
Yeah.
Really? Miles, use the microphone.
Yes, sir. And the question is,
the 45 stands for the caliber in thousandths of an inch. 0.45 is a little less than half an inch. So a 50-70 would be 50 caliber and 70 grains of black powder. The popular buffalo cartridges, the very first ones were 44 caliber, 77 grains of black powder, so 44-77, and a bottleneck case like the 30-06 that we shot today, rather than a straight tapered case like the 45-70 is a straight tapered case. So we started out with 44-77 and 50-70, and it was discovered that because the 50 caliber had quite a rainbow trajectory, not that it wouldn't kill buffalo, it just you couldn't shoot so far, so they increased the length of the case to 2.5 inches for the whole 90 or 100 grains of powder, depending how you chose to load it. As you read this book, you will find that the guys would put 30, 40 pounds of lead in a big cast iron skillet and melt that over a buffalo chip fire. When it had a nice blue sheen on it, then it was time to dip lead and pour bullets. So there was not only a hunter, but also a camp tender whose job it was to gather buffalo chips for the fire, to mold and cast bullets and reload cartridges. And one of the fun things about the archaeological excavation at the Adobe Walls Post down in the Texas Panhandle was the recovery of the sprues from casting bullets and stent primers and cartridge casings. And those that were most popular were the 4477 and the 5070 and 5090 there at that particular battle site. Bill asked about wearing out barrels. The guns were heavy, 12 pounds up to 16 pounds, and so you could shoot a bunch of rounds and the fatness of the barrel would absorb the heat until it got so hot, though, then also the bore would expand and your bullet would kind of wobble down the barrel. It's time to put it down, clean it out, pick up the other gun. Question way back there.
How many buffalo are currently left?
How many what?
Buffalo are left.
How many are left? Well, at the end of the game here, about 1884, Hornaday could account for less than 100. Michelle Pablo up in Montana, by Flathead Lake, was thoughtful and preserved some. Charles Goodnight kept some in Palo Canyon, Texas, and Charles Buffalo Jones, who had himself been a hive man, gathered up a bunch of calves, and he had his own buffalo herd there in Garden City, Kansas, and then brought them to the north rim of Grand Canyon, and that was the nucleus of the state of Arizona house-caught buffalo range. Nowadays, there are these national herds. There's one at Boise, Montana, one at Valentine, Nebraska, and one at Cache, Oklahoma. Those are national bison herds with hundreds of animals in each. They're bison and, of course, national zoos, and there are oodles of private ranchers who have big herds. Among which, if any of you have read Mike or Kathleen O'Neill Gears' books, The People of the Deer, The People of the Wolf, The People of the River, People of the Lake, any of those, you see these for sale in the bookstores and airports and so forth. They're very popular. Those kids are themselves professional archaeologists. They came into my camp in Wyoming in 77, I guess. Poor, cold, wet, miserable, unknown, and so we showed them hospitality. Here is, many years later, they show up at Casa Malapais, very wealthy, thank you. They've taken their knowledge of archaeology and written popular novels, and they have their own buffalo ranch at Thermopolis, Wyoming. So the moral of all this is, go out and write the great American novel. You too can own a buffalo.
I like it.
More questions or comments?
Thank you.
Anybody want to buy a 12-pound buffalo gun? We have fun with it.
For your information, while you're here, if you want to see some real live buffalo, if you've never seen buffalo before other than on television or something, if you go to Sholo, to Highway 60, turn right, you'll get to a point where you have a choice of going right or going straight or turning left and then going straight towards St. John's. Or you just go over Springerville and turn left on 191, which used to be 666. When you get up toward
Lyman Lake,
there's a small herd of six buffalo there that who is part owner of those buffalo. She was the first member of the buffalo club that purchased and maintains those buffalo. She has barn number one. So if you want to see some buffalo there right there, it's a Lyman Lake.
Right on.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Miles.
Thank you.
By the way, for those of you who don't know, Ann went to Gallup to pick up issue number 16 of Veritas, and she should be there probably around 6:30. Everybody will get a fresh copy.
And that's it for Miles's talk. This is the third hour in that series. And I just went to stop the tape and rewind it. I hope you enjoyed it. His talk on the ancient Indian cultures, their pictograms and pictographs, was extremely interesting. And the reason I asked Miles to come to the conference and give that talk was to clear up all the disinformation and misinformation, just outright lies, that you see on programs, on television, claiming that all of these rock paintings and rock pictures that have been left by the ancient cultures and the Native Americans somehow are telling you that extraterrestrials visited this earth and all of that kind of crap, and it's just not true. Miles showed us all of the different signs and symbols, and you got to hear it, but you couldn't see it. And a lot of the signs and symbols that people have claimed that the Indians left as the symbols of wormholes in space through which extraterrestrial beings visited the earth have no such meaning whatsoever. Don't mean any of those things. It's just total baloney. So Biles did an excellent job of dispelling the myths and the BS, which is really what it is, and setting everybody straight on that. And he also gave us an excellent talk on the old buffalo hunters of the Old West. And I think everybody, in fact, I know everybody at the conference really enjoyed every moment of it and sat in rapt attention and just ate it all up. I wish my radio audience could have seen the slides and some of the artifacts and bones and skulls and things that he had there to explain what it was that he was talking about. Unfortunately, you can't do that on radio, but Miles is such a gifted speaker that I think he did a pretty good job of conveying what all of that was simply in his talk without you having to see those things. So, good night, folks. Tune in tomorrow night at the same time for another episode of The Hour of the Time. This message is to my good friend Doyle Chandler. I know you're driving in tonight, Doyle, and if you're in hearing distance of this broadcast, we have a good meal waiting for you and can't wait to see you. Godspeed, and please drive safe. Thank you. You've been listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. This is 101.1 FM Eager, classic radio, like you always wished it could be, but very seldom ever is. 101.1 FM is your community service, nonprofit radio station.